I want to be too big to fail. I want to steal and not go to jail. I lost in Vegas. Won't somebody bail me out?
It's the Austin Lounge Lizards to set up our first guest today. And if you don't know Senator Bernie Sanders, there are two independents in the U.S. Senate, Joe Lieberman, who leans to the right of the Democratic Party, and Bernie Sanders, who leans to the left of it. Glenn Beck doesn't have to call Sanders a socialist. Sanders calls himself one informally. Unofficially, or I should say officially, he and Lieberman were elected as independents. They couldn't be more different on health care reform. Sanders supports a public option. Lieberman vows to filibuster it. And as we mentioned yesterday, he takes a tougher stance toward banking reform, does Bernie Sanders, than Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, the Senate Banking Committee chairman. Sanders has a bill that the Austin Lounge Lizards would love, called the Too Big to Fail, Too Big to Exist Act. So we'll talk about health and banks and maybe more now with Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont. Senator, thank you so much for coming on and welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
I understand your bill would direct Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner to identify all financial institutions considered too big to fail and break them up within a year. Do I have that right, and how would that work?
Page bill, and you've got it right. That's exactly right. Look, the bottom line here is we are in the midst of the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. If you add up the number of people who are unemployed, underemployed, people have given up looking for work, you're looking at 17% of the population, workforce population. And the immediate reason for that is because of the greed and the illegal behavior of the folks on Wall Street who could not control themselves and who plunged this country into where we are right now. Now, ironically, if we bail them out, and I voted against that bailout, but if the taxpayers put up $700 billion to bail them out, and if the Fed lent them another $2 trillion in zero interest loans or even more than that because they were too big to fail, well, you know what? Many of the largest institutions today are bigger than they were before the financial crisis. Now, that may make sense to somebody, but it doesn't make sense to me. So, number one, we're talking about an issue of ending the situation where if a major institution goes down, it takes the economy with it. And I think that's one reason to break them up. But the second reason is that because of their concentration of ownership, where you have the top four financial institutions in this country, and that's the Bank of America, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup, they today, Brian, are writing half of the mortgages in America. They are producing two-thirds of the credit cards in this country, and they control 40% of all bank deposits. So that then puts you in a position of kind of understanding why people are now paying 25 or 30% interest rates on their credit cards, while small businesses in this country are not getting the kinds of loans that they need. So I think there are a number of reasons to learn the lesson that Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, good Republicans, taught us 100 years ago, and it's time to break them up.
So those are some of the pitfalls and downsides of having companies that big. Here's a defense of the necessity of having some companies of that size. I asked the chairman of Citigroup, Richard Parsons, on this program about this idea of breaking up institutions that are too big to fail, and here's a little of how he defended their necessity.
If we're going to maintain our leadership as a leading economy in the world, you're going to have large, complex, interconnected institutions. And so we're just going to have to do a better job of regulating and understanding the risk that they're taking on.
Want to react to that? And we also heard Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, emphasize that interconnectedness rather than size.
Well, this gentleman talks about maintaining our leadership as one of the leading economies in the world. That's just not the case. We're not one of the leading economies in the world anymore. As I just mentioned, 17% of our people are unemployed or underemployed. Since we have moved into this deregulatory effort that was pushed by Wall Street, which did away with Glass-Steagall, which allowed the merging of investment banks and commercial banks and large insurance companies, what we have seen is a trend in which the middle class has significantly shrunk. Under Bush, median family income went down over $2,000 per family. Many people left the middle class and went into poverty. So the point is, he's not right. If you look at the economy today, if you look at the economy under Bush, when we had all of this deregulation, all of this concentration of ownership, I guess the economy was good for the top 1% and the heads, the CEOs of these banks, who made tens of millions of dollars a year, or in some cases, if they're running a hedge fund, maybe they made $1 billion. But for the middle class, it has not been good. Go out to small businesses all over this country today. And while Goldman Sachs has given out huge amounts of compensation packages and bonuses to their people, see if small businesses, the people who are creating real jobs in the productive economy, see if they're getting the kind of loans that they need. So I think that gentleman just doesn't have it right.
But could small banks really do all that the big banks do to generate economic activity, all that interconnectedness, again, especially overseas?
Generate economic activity. Excuse me. We are in the midst of the most severe recession since the Great Depression. What kind of economic activity are we talking about?
Well, that's now. There was a lot of growth before that. There's going to be growth again.
There was growth before that, but there was not growth for the middle class. In other words, if you look at the economic patterns in this country in the last 30 years, what you are seeing is an increase in poverty, a shrinking of the middle class, and a growing gap between the very, very rich and everybody else. Is that a trend that we really want to continue? So I think that no one is talking about, you know, creating, you know, tiny community banks. But I think the concept that has been so prevalent in this country for so many years, that a handful of large corporate interests, whether it is in financial services or whether it is in any other industry, is just not good for the country for many, many reasons. I think that principle it maintains to be true today.
How do you know a bank that's too big to fail when you see one? Is there a metric?
That's a good question. Well, that's what we're asking. The bill that I've introduced, which is all of 2 pages, does 2 things, as you've indicated. The first part is to give the Secretary of the Treasury 3 months to identify those banks. And what that means is really not hard to understand. It is, look, if a small businesses or medium-sized business goes bankrupt today, and that's happening all over this country, they're not too big to fail. You know, we say, oh, too bad, you know, your family has now gone, you know, your family is now in severe economic trouble, you've lost the business you've worked on your whole life. Well, that's the way life goes. But if you are Citigroup or if you're Bank of America and you go under, you're going to take a whole lot of other institutions with you. So that's what too big to fail is about. The reason, against my vote, that Congress bailed these guys out is the argument was if we do not sustain them, they're going to lead us into a financial collapse. So that is the metric. Mm-hmm. If an institution goes down, we'll have systemic damage to the entire economy. And that's what we're asking the Treasury Department to look at.
And remember the original Henry Paulson bailout bill? It was also 2 pages. Just give me the power to do anything at any time that I want.
That's right. No, it was actually, I think, it was 3 pages. Mine's even shorter than that.
My guest on WNYC, independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. We can take some phone calls for him on his Too Big to Fail, Too Big to Exist Act. We'll also get into health care and anything else you want to talk about. We'll just have time for a few questions, but if you get in right away, we can put you on with Bernie Sanders. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your question or comment, as always, to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And staying with the financial institutions, I gather you're also a sponsor in the Senate of something Ron Paul introduced in the House to have Congress audit the Federal Reserve. Now, the Fed chairman, Bernanke, has been described as apocalyptic about that. Why should Congress audit the Fed?
Well, I'll give you one reason. We had, and the reason that I introduced two bills, one with Ron Paul and one independently. And the reason I introduced legislation like this is very simple. We had Chairman Bernanke before the Budget Committee, on which I serve. And I asked the chairman, I said, my understanding is that the Fed has provided zero interest loans to the amount of about $2 trillion to some of the largest financial institutions in the United States. Would you please tell me and the American people who those financial institutions are? You put $2 trillion of taxpayer money at risk. Please name them. He said, nope, not going to tell you. On that day, we introduced legislation to make him tell us. It passes the laugh test. I mean, it doesn't pass the laugh test to have a situation where the Fed, a pretty secretive organization, is lending out $2 trillion in zero interest and not telling the American people who's getting the money. I mean, it is inconceivable. We had an amendment during the budget process, which won pretty handily on the floor of the Senate, which I think got Bernanke a little bit nervous. It was bipartisan. We had a lot of support from Republicans and Democrats, because it's very hard to go home and tell your constituents, oh, yeah, well, you're on the line for $2 trillion bucks, and I can't tell you who's gotten it. It is totally absurd. So we need a lot more transparency at the Fed, and we need an audit of it.
By the way, listeners, some of you are taking a shot at this already, but if you want to go to our webpage for the Bernie Sanders interview and post how you would recognize an institution that's too big to fail if you would see one. How would you know an institution that's too big to fail when you see one? Post your answers to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Opponents of auditing the Fed think this is crazy. You know that, right? That independence is so vital. They think that it's so vital to have an independent monetary policy and some other Fed functions that to subject them to the political winds could be disastrous for the economy, they say.
I mean, you know, this is so crazy. I mean, I agree with them that it's crazy, but the status quo is crazy. Go to the people in the state of Vermont or the people maybe any place other than Wall Street and say to them, we're putting $2 trillion of taxpayers' money at risk, but we can't tell you who got the money. We can't tell you what conflicts of interest exist. We can't tell you the kind of bonuses and compensation packages the heads of those corporations are getting because you don't know who gets it. That is insane. And, you know, no one is talking about micromanaging the Fed. But when you put trillions of dollars of taxpayer money at risk, of course the American people have a right to know.
How does Ron Paul as a libertarian and you as a socialist come to ideological common ground on auditing the Fed when so many in the so-called center are opposed?
Well, I've known Ron Paul for many, many years. I served in the House for 16 years. And obviously, Ron and I disagree on many, many issues. But we have worked together on a number of civil liberties issues. He is, you know, doesn't believe that the government should be probing every aspect of our lives. We have worked together on trade issues. Sometimes we come to the same conclusion for different reasons. But on this one, the issue of transparency is one that I think the vast majority of the American people support us on.
Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, my guest on WNYC, and Matthew, a recent grad from the Columbia University Business School. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks so much for calling the show.
I wanted to comment at first positively, and thanks for the senator's outspokenness during the Bush years. I think he was a voice of great reason and a very needed voice, crying in the desert, if you will. My comments related to the current subject are slightly more critical, though. I think that one of the things we should keep in mind today is that a lot of the radical changes that were made to the financial world over the last 60 years, frankly, led us to where we are today. And I think that the people need to look to the Senate for very instructed and collaborative guidance right now with the financial industry and not for, you know, immediate overnight radical changes.
Well, Matthew, let me just say this. I was a member of the Financial Institutions Committee in the House for 16 years. And as a member of that, what I saw is Wall Street and corporate interests and Alan Greenspan and Democrats such as Robert Rubin and others come together and tell us the need to deregulate and do away with many of the provisions that were put in during the Depression, which separated commercial banks from insurance companies from other types of banking interests. I think the evidence is pretty clear that allowing all of these very large financial institutions to merge together, to come up with, to be in a position of too big to fail and then having to be bailed out by taxpayers, was not a great idea. And I think we have got to, once again, take a hard look at the need to re-regulate Wall Street. So I think what you're looking at is some of the action that's taken place in the last 20 years.
Matthew, I'll give you one quick comeback if you want it.
Yeah, I would just say that re-regulation in an instructed and deliberate form is probably not only likely to happen, but vital. I would say that the notion of a forced breakup of institutions which are, for good or ill, very, very deeply ingrained in the way that things work, both financially and in the broader reaches of society today, is less of a good idea.
Well, Matthew, let me ask you this. Does it concern you that we have four financial institutions that write half of the mortgages in this country and two-thirds of the credit cards?
No, I'm aware that J.P. Morgan services 28% of the 44 million U.S. home mortgages out there. I'm a Chase customer myself. It is powerful. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
Whether a forced breakup is the answer is something I just would question.
Well, Matthew, I mean, I think you raise a good point in the sense that it's not going to happen over. I mean, it has to be done very thoughtfully. And I think that's your point, and I certainly agree with that. But I do think it has to happen.
Matthew, thank you for your call. Our time is going by so quickly. We have a few minutes left with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. I want to get to the health care bill. The House has its version now. A floor vote will take place soon in the Senate. And I see that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is considering a Medicare payroll tax hike on high-income earners instead of the proposed tax on the so-called Cadillac health insurance policies. Do you have a preference for one or the other?
Well, we want the payment, the revenue source to be as progressive as possible, and I will examine what Senator Reid is proposing. I think the House has come up with some good ideas as well. Well, let me just say this when we talk about health care. My own view is that if, as a nation, we are serious about comprehensive, universal, cost-effective, let's underline the word, cost-effective health care, at the end of the day, what we're going to move to is a Medicare-for-all single-payer system. Today, we are spending almost twice as much as any other country on earth per person on health care, and yet our outcomes are not as good as many other countries. I have some real concerns with the process that is now going on in terms of lack of cost containment. The good news is that many more people will be covered, and that is very important. We're looking at insurance company reform in terms of pre-existing conditions, et cetera. But I worry very much that we're really not getting a handle on the very, very high costs of health care in this country.
So on the Cadillac insurance plans tax, that would tax employers for family plans that cost $21,000 a year or $8,000 premiums for an individual plan that's offered by an employer. But that kind of connects with what you said about costs and full coverage. Is there an essential paradox in the idea coming out of mostly Democrats of promising people fuller health insurance coverage, but then using the tax code to discourage plans that cover us too well, or more broadly, saying we want better coverage for everybody, but we have to spend less?
The weakness of the, first of all, in terms of the politics of what's going on, it is a sad state of affairs that the Republicans basically are boycotting the discussion. They have nothing important to say in terms of dealing with this major American crisis in terms of health care. That is really sad. In terms of what the Democratic proposal is, what they are not getting to is the fact that every single year we are spending about $400 billion in terms of administering thousands and thousands of separate plans run by 1,300 private insurance companies. So if you really want to wring the waste out of our current non-healthcare system, you've got to look at all of the administration, the fact that we're spending about 30 cents of every dollar, not on healthcare, but on administration. That is what we're not looking at right now, and that's what a Medicare-for-all single-payer system would do.
But if you want a public option to compete with the private insurers, why would it be good to have one provider for everybody, as Medicare-for-all would be, with no competition?
Well, because the evidence is pretty clear internationally and in the United States through a program like Medicare that you do away with the administrative cost of having to run thousands and thousands of separate programs, each designed to make a profit. So if your goal is to get as much of every healthcare dollar into healthcare rather than into profiteering, into advertising, into CEO compensation, then a Medicare for All program does it.
Would your vision of that have multiple plans that people could choose from, more bare bones, whatever? Because then you're in the situation of the government, in order to control costs and make it affordable over the long run, having to cherry pick and say, not cherry pick customers like the insurance companies do, but say, okay, this is going to be covered, that's going to be covered, incentives that are going to create lines for some things, and it would all be centralized in the one decision maker, no?
But that's what goes on today. You have massive amount of rationing today, but that rationing is done by income. We have in this country, unbelievably, you know, our friend Sarah Palin talks about death panels. Let me tell you about a death panel. 45,000 Americans, according to a recent Harvard study, die each year because they don't go to a doctor when they should and they don't have health insurance. That's called a death panel. So what you need to do is to make sure that the money that we spend goes to doctors, goes to nurses, and we have a major crisis in primary health care doctors. We have to deal with the insurance companies and make sure that we're not continuing to pay the highest cost for prescription drugs of any country on earth. So what you need to do is to simplify the system, make it cost effective, and I think you have a Medicare type program where people have freedom of choice with regard to their doctor, with regard to their hospital. But you don't have 1,300 separate private insurance companies with thousands of plans, each one trying to make a profit.
U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, thank you so, so much for coming on and talking with us today about your Too Big to Fail, Too Big to Exist Act and health care reform. Brian Lehrer and WNYC coming up in just a minute. We will meet the brand new Westchester County Executive, Rob Astorino, who some of you may know as a sports talk host. Stay with us.